Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karmateksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Kempo Karta Rinpoche's Six Perfections, Ethics, by Lama Cathy Wesley. Once we learn the perfect virtue of generosity, we find ourselves opening more to others and acting less selfishly. The next step is to learn how not to harm others. Practicing the paramita of perfect ethics, we become stable and trustworthy protectors of others. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karmateksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Hello and good morning or good afternoon, and thanks very much for joining today. I'm Lama Cathy, and I'm doing a talk for the Columbus Karmateksum Choling Tibetan Buddhist Center. And the last few weeks, we've been talking about a teaching that our founder, the Columbus KTC's founder, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, did several years ago at our home monastery of Karma Triana Dharma Chakra. And in that teaching, he talked about how we change our behavior gradually and slowly over time through the six perfect virtues, which are a teaching of Mahayana Buddhism. So in any case, I'm going to go ahead and get this started with a short prayer today. Oh, Sanje Chudan Sochi Chonamla, Jang Chu Bardu Dani Kyapsu Chi, Daji Jin Sochi Pe Sunam Ki, Drola Pinchu Sanje Druparsho. In English? From now until enlightenment is reached, I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Through the practice of generosity and the other six perfect virtues, may we attain Buddhahood for the sake of all suffering beings. And now I'll recite a short prayer of dedication to the masters of the lineage. O Palin Sawe Lama Rinpoche, Tagi Chi Or Pede Ten Shula, Kadrin Jembo Gone Che Sunte, Kusum Tugging a Drup Sal Du So. Okay, thanks for joining this afternoon. I have for the last few weeks been sharing with everyone the teachings that Kempo Kartha Rinpoche gave a number of years ago at our home monastery in Woodstock, New York, on the topic of the six perfect virtues. So today we are up to the topic of moral ethics or Buddhist ethics. And so today I would like to talk about how we become better people. I think a lot of people start the practice of meditation in particular and the practice of Buddhism in general with the idea that by using the teachings and philosophies of Buddhism, they will be able to take care of their bodies and minds in a way that's healthy, nonviolent, and constructive. And so that is, I think, behind why we begin meditating in the first place. And it's also the reason why we continue to practice meditation, even after we've received some of the benefits. So if we look at the teachings of the Buddha in his teaching called the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha said that we all have the potential to awaken to our own basic enlightened nature. We all have what the Buddha called Buddha nature. We all have the potential to awaken from the sleep of ignorance. And the ignorance is ignorance of our Buddha nature. It's also, you could also say that it is ignorance of the interconnectedness of all sentient beings. And by awakening from that ignorance, we can find great purpose and meaning in our life, and also to act for the benefit of others. And so in the teaching on the six perfect virtues, he tells us, and the Buddha tells us how by thinking of others and putting others first, how thinking of others and putting others first allows us to let go of the cause of a lot of our suffering, which is our own selfish motivation. The Buddha called it ego fixation or ego clinging. And we all know that when we practice selfishness, the unhealthy kind. There's the healthy kind of selfishness where we take good care of ourselves, make sure we get enough sleep, make sure we get enough to eat, make sure we have all of the things that we need for a good life. That is the kind of selfishness that is positive. But where it goes, where selfishness goes wrong, is where we begin to think that we deserve more than others, that we are more important than others, and that we deserve to harm others in order to get our own happiness. And this harming of others to get our own happiness is the I guess you could say the chief problem of unhealthy selfishness, in that in thinking that we are superior to others, we actually begin to harm them. And by harming them, we actually cause harm to ourselves. This is because in the initial teachings of the Buddha, in the book, the Dhammapada, which is a collection of the Buddha's earliest sayings, the very first line in that text says, "We are what we think, all that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world." So we create our experience through the things we do over and over and over again. And acknowledging this, acknowledging that we, to a certain extent, create our own world by the things we think about and do over and over and over again, may at first seem like it's a hopeless situation. But because these are the things we do, we think, and we say, that part of it is potentially under our control. At first, it doesn't seem like it because the habit energy of doing specific things over and over again may make us think that there is no way we could change it. But the habit energy, because it's created by us, we create habits by what we do, think, and say over and over again. That habit energy can actually be turned in any direction we wish. And how do we do that? We do that by recognizing what is helpful action and leads to happiness, and what is unhelpful action and leads to suffering. So if we can somehow see into our minds and lives and see into what brings about lasting happiness, as opposed to what brings about perhaps temporary happiness, but then causes suffering and sorrow for other beings, and begin to do less of that which causes harm and more of that which causes benefit. And so in this way, we can eventually take our experience of the world into our own hands and create a different world for ourselves by what we think, say, and do. And so for those of us who've been practicing meditation for a while, we know that because of when we practice meditation, we can feel a moment of peace and a moment of release for our minds when we are able to sit and practice meditation. And when we practice meditation, for many of us, the breath is the object for our meditation. And when we are aware of our breathing as it comes in and goes out, thoughts will cross our mind. And as those thoughts cross our mind, we may let them go past, or we may grab them. We may say, "Oh yes, I want to think about this. I want to place this on my mind." And then when we do that, we are taken away from our meditation into a distraction. And the techniques of meditation, what do they tell us to do when we are taken away by a distraction? The instructions say, notice the distraction. You can even label it thinking. You can let go of it and then return your attention to the breath for a fresh start for your meditation. And so this very simple action of noticing and discarding a distraction is proof to us that we have the potential to change anything that is on our mind at any moment. If we can change one thought in meditation, we can change all of our habitual tendencies, which are created from these momentary thoughts. And so in order to become better people and to begin to do more benefit and less harm, we start with our minds. And so in the teaching that Kempo Karthi Rinpoche gave a number of years ago on the six perfect virtues, he says that for many people, making a mental promise to themselves is the way they begin to change their minds. And he said, you can imagine that the Buddha is in front of you and you can make a promise to the Buddha saying, I will do my best to tame my mental afflictions. I will do my best to tame my bad habits. I will do my best to improve the benefit that I do for others. And then daily, he recommends that daily you think of this in the morning. And then daily you think of this in the evening. And when you think of this in the evening, you think, well, what benefit for beings did I do today? I helped this person. I helped that person. I restrained myself from doing this bad thing. I restrained myself from doing that bad thing. And in that way, I rejoice. I think about and then rejoice in the things that I have done that are beneficial. Additionally, I think about the things that I have done that are not beneficial, the things that I've done that are harmful. The people perhaps I told lies to, the people I said something sharp and mean to, or people that I've actively harmed or even thought about harming, wishing harm on somebody. All of these things I think about, I form a feeling of regret about, and I make the promise that tomorrow I will do better. And this is how we change our actions. I know it sounds overly simple, but by making a promise to ourselves and making a promise to the Buddha, we can gradually become better people. Because when we make a promise and then keep the promise through analyzing our day at the beginning and the end of the day, we then plant the idea more deeply that we are in the process of becoming a better person. And then we can begin to take in stride the mistakes we make and say we'll do better tomorrow. And we can begin to rejoice in the good that we do and say, may I do more of that. I remember giving a talk about the one of the six perfect virtues about ethics at a Unitarian church a number of years ago. And someone came up to me afterwards and said, oh, I'm so glad to hear that Buddhist philosophy doesn't just tell us the thou shalt nots. In other words, we don't have a list of 10 bad things, but then, then refrain from saying, here are 10 good things. We say there are 10 negative actions and 10 positive actions, and we encourage people to do the positive ones and discourage them from doing the negative ones. She said, that just seems like it makes so much more sense than the tradition, she said, I grew up in. So in any case, this is how we do it. This is how we make change. We take responsibility for ourselves. A lot of my friends in the 12-step tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery, they talk about self-honesty and how important self-honesty is, being honest with ourselves about who we've been, where we've been, and what we've done. We might think that at first we'll get discouraged if we take an honest look at ourselves. But we also have to remember that we are equally capable of doing benefit for beings as well as for harming beings. And so self-honesty begins a momentum of something beneficial. Self-honesty begins a taking of responsibility for ourselves and a taking of responsibility for our impact on others in the world. And so self-honesty is the beginning of actually making a change in our life and minds. So in any case, I wanted to talk a little bit about the framework first for Buddhist ethics, which is we are what we think, all that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world. And that if we think, speak, and act with a pure mind, happiness follows us. And if we think, speak, and act with an impure mind, suffering follows us. These are the original first verses in the collection of the Buddha's sayings, the Dhammapada. And so, in other words, we build a world by what we think all the time. If we're always angry and always concerned about punishing or harming others, we're going to live in a world where we have lots of enemies and they all have to be punished like all the time and so forth. Whereas if we think beneficial thoughts about ourselves and others, we're going to live in a world that is saturated with and permeated with this virtuous wish, and that virtuous wish itself bears fruit in that we feel differently when we're in a virtuous state of mind as opposed to a non-virtuous state of mind. So that's a little bit about the difference between virtue and non-virtue and how it makes us feel. So I did promise that I was going to share Kempo Rinpoche's teachings on the third of the six perfect virtues, practice of ethics and morality. He said that the word for ethics and morality in Sanskrit is shila, S-H-I-L-A, and in Tibetan it's sultrim, T-S-U-L-T-R-I-M. We need to learn proper discipline for changing our minds. At the time of the Buddha, Kempo Rinpoche said, there were many ideas about what proper discipline was, and especially proper religious discipline. Some people, some religious groups thought that you, in order to have a happy life, you had to kill and sacrifice animals in order to placate gods that would control your experience of the world. Whether you were happy or sad depended on offerings made to the gods. And so the Buddha said that the gods are not responsible for our state of mind. We are responsible for our own state of mind. And killing an animal is not a beneficial thing. Killing in general leads to the sense that it leads to a sense of within ourselves of, I guess you could call it like a spiritual brutality. And killing and thinking that killing is good just causes so much suffering for others, but then it also causes suffering for ourselves as we realize that we become less and less human and more like an animal ourselves. So the Buddha, in his teachings, he said that's a wrong kind of discipline, the killing of animals to placate gods. He said, this is just not what we should be doing. It's not the way to permanent happiness. Another philosophy that was popular at the time of the Buddha was extreme asceticism. An ascetic reduces the amount of food they take in, they reduce the amount of comfort their body feels, and in fact, they increase the amount of discomfort their body feels, thinking that if they deny the body nourishment and deny the body comfort, that this will make their mind rise up and be transcendent. The Buddha also said that this extreme asceticism was also incorrect practice and incorrect discipline. And so he advocated what became known as the middle path of somewhat comfort and somewhat discomfort. He said that people should practice with some bodily comfort and should not deny themselves and not starve themselves. They should eat nourishing food, but not too much. And in other words, he said they should balance their experience of the world through their physical relationship to the world. And so in contrast to these two ideas, extreme asceticism and killing animals as a sacrifice to placate gods, the Buddha instead advocated a path of middle discipline in which we recognize that we are what we think, and then we began to make changes in how we think through the practice of meditation and began to make changes in our thoughts and behavior through the application of Buddhist ethics. And he said that there are three aspects to moral discipline. He said that if we practice moral discipline properly, we will have a happy experience in this life and a positive rebirth in our future life, because the Buddha taught that we don't just have one life, that the minds that we have today, we have always had from the no beginning of time, and we'll always have them to the no ending of time. And therefore, this lifetime that we're in right now is very important, because we can make a change in our karmic trajectory by the thoughts, words, and actions we cultivate right now in this lifetime. And so the Buddha recommended in this lifetime we take advantage of our precious life to practice meditation, to practice the benefit of others, and to practice not harming others. And so this is, and then he gave guidelines. He didn't just say, don't do bad things. He said, here are the 10 negative actions. Here are the 10 positive actions. Reduce the amount of harm you do. Increase the amount of benefit you do. And then practice meditation so that you know the difference between harm and benefit. So when we teach the third of the six perfect virtues, second of the six perfect virtues. The first one was generosity. Second is ethics and morality. Third one is patience. The second of the six perfect virtues is moral discipline. There are three aspects to it. One is restraint from harm. We practice the abstention of harm through conscious restraint. He said we vow in the presence of the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and live in an active promise not to do negative things, promising not to do the 10 non-virtuous action. It is this conscious commitment not to do wrong. And then the second kind of moral discipline that the Buddha gave was amassing the causes of happiness, doing things that are positive as opposed to negative. We avoid complacency about our lives, avoid thinking, well, I'm just kind of here in this life and it's kind of good and it's kind of comfy, so I'm just going to enjoy myself. In other words, the Buddha said, don't be like that. Take advantage of the relative comfort that you have right now in this life to do good and to help others. He said, we don't sit and think, okay, that's enough. I've done enough good things. We should regard love and compassion as central to our practice and should practice love and compassion toward ourselves and others every day. And this will lead us to the third aspect of moral discipline, which is benefiting others. When we cease to harm beings and begin to amass positive actions, if we cease harming and abandon the negative actions, and we begin to amass good actions and virtuous thought states, mind states, the outcome of all of this is that we will be able to benefit others. People who practice this kind of discipline, Rinpoche says, will automatically benefit others with their demeanor and the direction of their aspiration. In other words, when we practice positive actions, thoughts, and words, we become sources of inspiration for other people who are trying to become better themselves. If we can practice benefit on our own, in our own way, if we can practice benefit, then others will be inspired by that. Seeing what we do, they'll be inspired by that, and they'll want to do the same. And so he said that in this way, love and compassion are not ineffectual passive states. Love and compassion are not ineffectual states. They are very powerful states. And I'll get back to that in a minute, because at the end of the talk today, I want to talk about how we in this modern life and modern world, how can we work with and overcome the evil done by others? So I'll get to that aspect of discipline at the very end of the talk. But for right now, because it's part of the teaching on moral discipline to talk about the 10 virtuous actions and the 10 non-virtuous actions, I'm going to talk about that, those next. And for my source on this, there are a number of sources of the 10 virtuous and 10 non-virtuous actions. The six perfect virtues in general are described in detail in Gampopa's book, The Jewel Ornament of Liberation. There are many different translations of this, and I recommend that you read those if you would like to read it in their original translation. But more than that, I'd like to recommend that you read Trungpa Rinpoche, that's T-H-R-A-N-G-U, Trungpa Rinpoche's commentary on the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, which explains the all of the chapters of Jewel Ornament in detail, which is really helpful because the work itself is quite dense and not easy to understand. Additionally, you can read about the six perfect virtues and the 10 virtues and non-virtues in Kempo Carter Rinpoche's book, Dharma Paths. But because it's a short, because this particular book has a very short statement about the 10 virtuous actions and the 10 non-virtuous actions, I'm going to be working from the book, The Torch of Certainty by Jamgon Kontrol. That's K-O-N-G-T-R-U-L. Jamgon Kontrol, who lived in the 19th century and the early 20th century. So he said in his work, he said, the accumulation of negative deeds is the root of suffering in this world that the Buddha called samsara. Conflicting emotions are to blame for all of our bad deeds. Ignorance, which holds our self-concept dear, is to blame for conflicting emotions. Mental darkness is the root of ignorance and of all conflicting emotions. Because of mental darkness, meaning that we don't recognize that we have Buddha nature, not knowing that we have Buddha nature and not knowing that we have the potential to awaken, this mental darkness, we do not know where samsara comes from. We don't know its nature. We don't know what types of actions, causes, and results are helpful and what are harmful and so on. We are in the dark. So so he says, when a teacher, let's say, for example, a Buddhist teacher, explains the nature of reality, after listening and thinking about what the teacher has said, we may reach a conceptual understanding of what the teacher has said. But just like daydreaming of a land we have never visited, when we apply conceptual designations to ultimate reality, which is not a thing, we are simply playing with concepts. By the same process, we apply the designation self to that which is not a solid, separate self. And then we cling to that self. Based on this clinging, doubt about ultimate reality and many other perverted attitudes arise. Then, attachment to anything which supports the self, such as the body, wealth, and so on, consequently arise. That brings about pride, jealousy, and greed. Aversion to that which is other or not like us, and consequently, burning anger, malice, and the like erupt. If we are free of mental darkness, attachment, and aversion, so that's ignorance, attachment, and aversion, these three emotional poisons described by the Buddha, our actions will not accumulate negative karma. Since results do not come about without actions, we must do what we can to dig up these three roots of our wandering in samsara. To summarize the topic of action which leads to the experience of this world of suffering or samsara, non-meritorious action, grouped into the list called the 10 unwholesome acts, leads to lower rebirths and experiences in samsara. In other words, we have a lot more suffering in samsara. Meritorious actions, including generosity and so on, if it is not motivated by the desire to achieve some high state like nirvana, leads to rebirths that are higher. In other words, we have more happiness and positivity in our experience. And then he says, imperturbable action, meaning transcendent action, such as samadhi, that is resting in meditative absorption, which involves clinging, leads to a rebirth in the form or formless realms, meaning one then has sort of a neutral experience and neither experiences happiness nor peace. In brief, until our propensities for conceptualization have been exhausted, in other words, until we really understand the nature of our minds and really understand the nature of our lives, this continuous pattern of karmic accumulation will not be disturbed, and the illusion which is samsara will be perpetuated. A stupid person who, since his meditation is a blank void, says, "Ah, I have understood the ultimate nature of mind. I don't have to worry about my actions and their consequences," is a great thief of the doctrine. In other words, people who practice a state of a vacuum, a vacuous state, or a blank meditative state, thinking, "Oh, I have achieved Buddhahood, and now it doesn't matter what I do," he said that this is not correct. So then Jhamrud Kantrol gives the list of the virtuous and unvirtuous actions. He starts with the 10 unwholesome actions. He says there are three, by the way, there are three of body, four of speech, and three of mind. Again, to summarize, three negative actions of body, four negative actions of speech, and three negative actions of mind. First, do not consciously take the life of any living being, not even an insect, for when it comes to life, there is no big or small. Well, we're going to have a little bit of a problem there, because sometimes we have to kill mosquitoes in order to prevent disease, or we will have to kill animals that bring disease. And so Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, when talking about this problem, said sometimes you just have to pray for the powerful and positive rebirth of the animals that die, because we're trying to protect our human lives and our health. And so he often advocated reciting the compassion mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, for animals that die as a result of our attempting to have clean homes and better health. Still, if we make a promise to the Buddha not to kill, and then we call the exterminator to come and get our cockroaches, we are committing a negative deed. But this is why the Buddha offered also the practice of confession. By confessing our negative faults in front of the Buddha, we can ask that they are purified, we can give them up, offer them to the Buddha, and then ask for them to be purified. Kempo Kartha Rinpoche said that the only good thing about bad karma is that it can be purified. Karma is not an absolute, it can be purified. So anyway, back to the list. Second, do not secretly take another's property when it has not been offered to you. In other words, don't steal. Third, do not engage in sexual relations with inappropriate partners in inappropriate ways, in inappropriate places, and so on. This is mainly for those who are ordained not to engage in sexual conduct of any kind, and for those who are married not to engage in adultery. Now we come to the four negative actions of speech. Do not consciously lie, that is, don't say what is untrue. Do not slander, that is, say things which will promote discord. do not speak ill of others. That is, call a person a thief or a half-wit or hurt the feelings of others by cruelly exposing their faults. These are the four negative actions of speech. Consciously lying, discordant or divisive speech, speaking harshly to others, and then the last one is engaging in idle chatter or gossip. Then the three negative actions of mind are: do not covet someone else's money, reputation, and so on, thinking, oh, if only I had that. So covetousness is the first of the three negative actions of mind. The second is do not hold ill will toward others, being displeased by their happiness and good fortune and so on. And then the last one is do not hold perverted views, that is to doubt the existence of action, cause, and result, and the special qualities of awakening. And so he says, to sum up, when each of these 10 unwholesome actions has fully matured, you will be reborn in negative states. And so he said, since all of these acts lead to many sorrows, simply avoid them. Dissuade others from committing them and regret those which have been committed by you. So this was his presentation on the 10 negative actions that lead to suffering. Then he gives a teaching on the positive actions which lead to happiness. He said, instead of killing, save lives. Instead of stealing, distribute your own food and money. Preserve your moral conduct, whether anyone is watching or not. Then speak truthfully. Patch up quarrels caused by slander. Use gentle words. Discuss worthwhile topics. Rejoice in the good fortune of others. Think only of their benefit. Practice goodwill toward others. And when you hear the views of other Buddhist groups or other faith traditions, do not denounce them, but simply maintain your faith in the Buddha's words. I think this last one is kind of important. I remember when I took refuge and became a Buddhist more than 40 years ago with Kempo Carter Rinpoche. When I took my refuge vows, at the conclusion of that, Rinpoche said, there are certain things that I would like to make sure you do. Number one, you should respect images of the Buddha, but you should also respect the images of other faith traditions. You shouldn't denigrate the images of other faith traditions. Second, he said, you should respect all of the books of the Dharma, whether they're from your group of Buddhism or another group of Buddhism, but also you should respect the texts of other religious groups. Don't denigrate them, criticize them, and so on. Third, you should show respect to members of the Buddhist community. But he said you also should show respect to the followers of other faith traditions, not saying, I am Buddhist and my faith tradition is superior to others. And the reason he said this was because no matter what the followers of various faith traditions do, no matter what, all of the faith traditions in the world, Rinpoche said, all the faith traditions in the world were created to benefit others. And so for us as Buddhists to decry them, to criticize them, to publicly desecrate their symbols and so on is it's unseemly and it causes division. So he said, please don't do any of those things. And it was really interesting because a lot of people back in the 70s, a lot of people were becoming Buddhist at a very young age, teenagers or early 20s. And they were doing it partially to get back at their parents who had raised them as strict Christians or in some other faith tradition. And so they were becoming Buddhist almost as a reaction against the church of their childhood, which they felt had harmed them in some way. So I encourage everyone to do their best not to be critical of faith traditions and to remember that they were all founded with the benefit of other beings in mind. So in conclusion, Ajahn Chontral says, these are the 10 wholesome actions. Do your best to carry them out. Encourage others to do the same. Rejoice at those which have already been done. As a result, you will have long life in good in a good rebirth experience, possessing many comforts and so on. So then he talked about neither wholesome nor unwholesome actions or intermediate actions. And I'll just read this paragraph because I love Ajahn Chontral because he's kind of a no-nonsense writer. I mean, you can kind of see where he's coming from. And he always just tells it straight. He says, you might kill time by walking, moving, sleeping, or sitting, ineffectual actions which are neither wholesome nor harmful, and which mature into neither good nor bad experiences in karma. But since such actions simply waste your time, instead of throwing your ability away in idle amusements, make a conscious effort to devote your time exclusively to wholesome action. Avoid carelessly committing even minor harmful acts, thinking that even a small amount of poison could be fatal. Do not underestimate the power of even a minor wholesome act. Recalling enough grains of barley will eventually fill the bag. So he's saying two things in this last paragraph. Number one, he's saying that there are some actions that are neither wholesome nor unwholesome, but they waste time. And I, for one, am a person who will claim today that I waste a lot of time on the internet. And so I have done my best to try to reduce my interaction with the internet, but yet I teach on the internet, so it's kind of a complicated thing. So, but this is something that I think a lot of us are concerned about. And a lot of us are trying to consciously cut back the amount of time we spend online every day. And I would encourage all of you to like say, you know, for a half an hour, I'm going to put my phone away and not look at it. I'm going to put my tablet away and not look at it. And that would be a more or less painless way to not waste time. So it's something to think about, maybe just doing like a little bit smaller, like put it away for half an hour in the morning, put it away for half an hour in the evening, or maybe go stronger and longer with that, you know, so just a little bit more time away. So in any case, what we're trying to accomplish in refraining from the unwholesome actions and doing the wholesome actions is create within ourselves an atmosphere of virtue. When you can think about this, this idea of karma may seem like it's very theoretical, very intellectual, and like somehow if I harm a lot of people, then it's going to like have me experience suffering in the future, but I don't exactly know the mechanism of that. And so we might have some doubts about that. Interestingly, the Buddha himself was asked about the inner workings of karma, and he refused to discuss it. So he said try to explain the inner workings of karma would cause us vexation. He said it would cause us to be vexed. So even the Buddha would not explain the inner workings of karma. But you and I, we can actually understand the effect. Even if we don't understand the inner workings, we can understand the effect just by reflecting. Cast your mind back to the last time you got really mad at somebody and you gave them a piece of your mind, and you might have, and you yelled, or maybe you made them feel small, or maybe you you persecuted them or were passive aggressive toward them or whatever. If we practice this kind of negativity toward other people, we actually might feel a tiny bit of satisfaction at having gotten the better of them, But then what happens is that our body has been flooded with all kinds of stress chemicals. And then we actually feel like maybe a little sick to our stomach. It might have a little pain in our chest. And we might actually like feel tense and our mouth might get dry. And it not that I've ever felt these things before, but it's just in case, you know, for the purpose of discussion, that we would just feel bad. And that bad feeling kind of like goes on and on and on. And for some people, what happens is when you do this to others a lot, you actually get a lot of it back, coming back at you. When you treat others badly, they treat you badly in return. And so this kind of cycle of negativity continues. It feeds itself. Whereas if we help somebody, if we practice like virtue, giving them something they need, saying a nice word when they're discouraged and so forth, if we can do this kind of benefit, our body feels relaxed, our body feels at peace, and we get this positive stuff back from other people. And so this whole idea of karma is not just about some kind of hidden interworking. It's actually something we can feel in our own lives and minds from what we feel when we do negative things as opposed to when we do positive things. So I would like to recommend positive things to you. Today, I recommend positive things. And my hope is that by hearing this this talk about Buddhist ethics, that you'll consider starting your day by saying, okay, I here are my bad tendencies and faults, and here are the things that I want to do good today with. And so may I do the good and not do the bad. And then at the end of the day, be self-honest, practice self-honesty, and say, I am slowly becoming a better person. I regret my mistakes, and I rejoice in my successes. So it's my hope that you will add this to your daily meditation routine. Next week, I'm going to talk about the practice of diligence, which I basically, they call it joyous effort or joyful effort in Buddhism. So a lot of people say to me, I want to do what's right and I want to do things that are good for me, but I can't seem to do the things that are good for me. I can't seem to get motivated to do the things that are good for me. But on the other hand, I will do lots of things that are bad for me. So we're going to talk about how to get over the hump of that next week. But for right now, let's see, we have just a few minutes left. So I'm going to do a little short meditation based on Kempo Carter Rinpoche's book, Dharma Paths. We're going to do a little bit of compassion meditation, Tong Len, T-O-N-G-L-E-N, Tong Len. Tong means to send and Len means to take. So we'll start by sitting on our meditation seat or lying comfortably on the floor. Settling into a meditation posture, hands palm downward on the legs, chin tucked in slightly. Eyes can either be closed or cast downward. And we become aware of our breath as it comes in and goes out. Recognizing that we need to practice that which is excellent. We make the excellent aspiration, thinking, may my meditation be a benefit to others. Then practicing excellence in the middle. We think that with every out-breath, we send our love, our goodness, our merit, and our virtue, we send it outward from us to all of the beings in the universe. We think that that goodness touches them and relieves their suffering. We do that on the out-breath. Next, on the in-breath, we think that we bring in the negativity and the suffering and the difficulties of all sentient beings. We imagine that all of this comes to us, and as it enters us, it meets with the pure bodhisattva motivation that we have, and that it dissolves into nothing and disappears. We think that as we breathe in and remove the suffering from others, it meets our pure motivation. All that suffering dissolves into nothing and disappears. And in this way, we breathe out and give goodness, and breathe in and remove suffering. After doing this for a short time, we let go of the visualization and allow our mind to rest in a place where there is no us, no sentient beings, no active meditation, just allowing the mind to rest comfortably in itself. We practice excellence at the end of the meditation by dedicating the merit and goodness to all sentient beings. Now, I did promise one thing, and that was I promised to share Kempo Rinpoche's teaching about how love and compassion are powerful. Kempo Rinpoche, at the end of his discussion of Buddhist ethics, said, love and compassion are not ineffectual states that are merely love and merely compassion. They are very powerful. There seem to be in this world many different kinds of beings, and some of them are very powerful, and some of them these beings are very powerful, and some of these beings do many bad things. They harm others. But, he said, it has been shown many times that no matter how powerful these negative beings might seem, the one thing these negative beings cannot overcome is the power of love and compassion. When confronted by love and compassion, they are changed. They are converted from harming others to helping others. We know that the opposite approach, trying to match negative beings in anger, never works. But love can overcome. And in these days in which social justice seems to be lacking in our world, and many beings are doing harm to others, we are reminded of the power of the great people of the past, of Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., and Thich Nhat Hanh, and all of the great beings who practice love and nonviolence. And their love was not ineffectual. It was powerful, and it showed the evil and oppression of their societies. We have not corrected these injustices. We have not corrected all of the things that are unfair and wrong, but we can't give up. And so it's my hope that by talking about this practice of benefiting others, that we will slowly and gradually increase the love in our own hearts and do away with the bias and negativity in our own hearts. So I'm going to dedicate the merit of our session today to all of you who are struggling right now, especially those who are troubled by the pandemic, those who are troubled by politics and by the very harsh economic realities of our time. I make the aspiration that all beings are free from suffering and come to Buddhahood. I'm going to recite a short prayer in English. Through this merit, may all achieve the omniscience of Buddhahood. May it defeat our common enemy, wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may we free all beings. May we free all beings. May we free all beings. Thanks to all of you who are watching on YouTube. And thanks to all of you who are watching on Facebook. Thank you. See you next time.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.